Welcome to the debrief, everyone. The mayor of Chicago has fired her city's police superintendent just before he planned to retire. The mayor says Chief Eddie Johnson committed what she called a series of ethical lapses that are intolerable. The mayor said the termination followed an incident on October 17th where Johnson was found asleep in his car. Johnson said he had changed medications and had had a couple of drinks that day. The mayor said in October, when this happened, she would wait for an internal affairs investigation before taking any action. Johnson, while in office, harshly criticized actor Jussie Smollett and accused the actor of falsely reporting a racist attack. There's no official indication that his criticism played into his termination. New York's Child Victims Act is resulting in a new lawsuit against the former personal attorney of millionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Accuser Virginia Giuffre's attorney told a federal judge this morning that she will use the new law to sue former Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz. The two are already locked in civil litigation. Giuffre accuses Dershowitz of defaming her by calling her a liar, an accusation Dershowitz has levied frequently on this network towards her.
I want to tell you unequivocally, I never met this woman. If she says under oath that she ever met me, she will be committing perjury. And I want the FBI and the Justice Department to decide who to prosecute. You can't allow two affidavits to be in front of a federal court, which are categorically inconsistent. One of which says I never met her. The other one said she had sex with me. One of us is lying. It's not me. I want the FBI to investigate and let the chips fall where they may.
Here early tonight, our attorneys Adam Conta, Catherine Smith, and Michael Bryant. So, Adam, I'll start with you. This is under New York's Child Victims Act. It's a law that took effect not too long ago. It's being used to sort of claw back into the legal sphere a lot of cases that would not have been in court because of a statute of limitations.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a tremendous step for victims of sexual abuse, and it's allowed them to seek some redemption in situations that they would have been previously barred at. That being said, however, in this particular case, you know, I think her ultimate motivation here is to attack the 2008 plea deal that gave Jeffrey Epstein such a sweetheart deal that Mr. Dershowitz helped put together. If she can in any way show that he had ulterior motivations because he was in some way linked to the allegations, then that's going to be a big deal.
Catherine Smith, we've got the royal family attached to this thing. We have high-profile attorneys locked in civil cases here. We've got the criminal cases here, there, and everywhere. This has just been a tangled web of legal, what do we call it?
Exactly. I mean, the civil avenue is really fantastic because not only does it offer a new avenue of redress for victims, but can also really speed up the sworn testimony of, in this case, Dershowitz. He would be forced to produce documents and also to provide testimony if this case is allowed to go forward. So I think we're in for some interesting stuff ahead.
Michael Bryant, I agree with Catherine on this. What are your thoughts?
You know, it's interesting because ultimately it's still a he said, she said. Until something bubbles to the surface suggesting there is independent corroboration of either story, it's going to plod along right to the court system, and I can't wait to watch it unfold.
Corroboration not necessary in New York sex crimes cases. New York got rid of that requirement long ago, but for those of us observing, it certainly would make the case that much easier, as you point out, Michael Bryant. Let's go now to the trial of a Florida man accused of killing his wife and business partner. Mark Sievers charged with being the ringleader behind the murder of Dr. Teresa Sievers. A colleague found Dr. Sievers beaten to death with a hammer in her own home. Husband Mark Sievers is on trial right now. Co-defendant Curtis Wright pleaded guilty and testified against both the husband and the third co-defendant, Jimmy Rogers. Rogers is in prison after a second-degree murder conviction. The first witness today examined whether fibers from coveralls worn by co-defendant Jimmy Rogers matched fibers found elsewhere, including in the rental car Rogers and Curtis Wright are said to have taken to Florida.
Variegated cotton fibers comprising item 32, coveralls from near roadway, were recovered from the following. Debris from left floor of Hyundai Elantra, vacuum sweepings from right rear seat in floor, tape lift from front of dress from Teresa Sievers, tape lift from left leg of Teresa Sievers, and items 1 through 1-2, which were vacuum sweepings from kitchen floor of 2703 Jarvis Road. Accordingly, these fibers are consistent with originating from item 32 or another item comprised of fibers that exhibit the same microscopic characteristics and optical properties.
On cross, the defense pressed a theme we've heard before, that there were no animal fibers from the Seavers family pets on the coveralls.
I can't speak to the way they're manufactured.
Okay.
I don't know.
How many jumpsuits did you perform the analysis on?
Just the one.
Did you find any cross transfer with respect to any of the collections from the, we'll start with the Hyundai Elantra. Did you find any cross transfers from the Elantra?
I didn't find any other associations that I haven't testified to.
After killing Dr. Seavers at the defendant's direction, prosecutors say Curtis Wright and Jimmy Rogers took off in their rental car and headed back home to Missouri, leaving a graphic and bloody murder scene behind them. However, none of the victim's DNA turned up in the car they drove.
Well, all of the hairs excluded Teresa Seavers as a potential contributor to the DNA, which means that in comparing her reference, her head hair sample, to all of those hairs that I tested, I obtained a conclusion that I would exclude for all of those.
Did you find any anything that would tend to link Teresa Seavers and her DNA profile to the inside of the Hyundai Elantra?
Teresa Seavers was excluded as a source of all of the hairs that I tested from the Hyundai Elantra.
A key witness in this case is the ex-girlfriend of co-defendant Jimmy Rogers. She said everything started to unravel when authorities came to ask about Rogers' whereabouts.
He got his phone out of a locker and put it in a drinking fountain and then stomped it and smashed it.
Where did you all go next, or what did you do?
Drove back towards our home, and he had me throw it out the window piece by piece.
The phone?
Yes.
Was there anything else that during that car ride he asked you to throw out?
Not that I remember.
Did there come a time when you got back to your home with him?
Mm-hmm.
Did you end up taking another car ride with him to throw out something else?
He told me we were going to my mom's, I think it was, and he grabbed other things. And on the way to my mom's, he had me throw out more things.
And was one of those things a pair of overalls or coveralls?
Yes.
And do you remember where you threw them out?
On Highway 47.
That co-defendant's ex-girlfriend also testified about suspicious items she saw in a backpack and in a cooler.
I don't remember seeing anything like as soon as I walked in.
Did there come a time when you looked inside the cooler or saw what was inside the cooler?
Yes.
And what did you see inside the cooler?
I believe it was the jumpsuit, the gloves, the hammer, and I think it was his shoes that was in there with it.
Do you remember the color of those shoes at this time?
Yeah, they were like black dress shoes, but had like the sole of a boot.
And was there anything in the backpack that you saw on the counter that he brought back?
That was the jumpsuit.
This ex-girlfriend also described a startling admission from Jimmy Rogers himself.
I knew that you had something to do with this.
And then did you ask him a question?
I did.
What did you ask him?
I asked him.
Noted for the record, overruled.
I had asked him if he killed her with a gun.
And what did he say to you?
No.
Did he tell you how he killed her?
He said they killed her with a hammer.
As we reported during the first trial in the case against Jimmy Rogers, the state is paying this witness $400 a month. Prosecutors tried to get out in front of any argument that the money could affect her credibility.
Because my car was gone, my house was gone, and I had no way to do anything or work.
What did Detective Downs say when you called him?
That he'll see what he can do.
At the end of February, was Detective Downs able to do something?
Yes.
And what was it that he was able to do?
He was able to help me with my rent.
And how much money do you receive? How much money did you receive?
I don't know. I know that I got $400 a month.
So has it been $400 each month?
Except for the very first check, it was first and last.
That ex-girlfriend of co-defendant Jimmy Rogers testified that she saw Rogers with a ball-peen hammer. But co-defendant Curtis Wright said Jimmy Rogers killed Dr. Seavers with a claw hammer. Listen to both pieces of testimony.
You said you saw a ball-peen hammer. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I do remember that.
And just so we're all clear, a ball-peen hammer isn't the hammer that has the two ends protruding. It has the kind of the ball on the other side of the striking surface. Is that correct?
Both sides had like a ball on them.
Okay. Okay. So that's what you recall seeing in the cooler.
Yes.
Do you recall if you remember Mr. Rogers bringing that with him when he left for Florida?
I do not. I don't remember seeing him pack any kind of bags.
I dropped my hammer right there on the floor. When I walked over to get Jimmy to stop, he actually turned around and ran back, and he was laughing about it. He said he used the claw part of the hammer.
And he hit her again?
Yeah.
If there's a hammer that was sitting on that was found sitting on the floor of the kitchen next to Dr. Seaver's body, whose hammer was that?
Well, where I was standing at would have been at where our feet were at, but that would have been mine.
What happened to Jimmy Rogers' hammer?
I don't know.
Back now, attorneys Adam Conta, Catherine Smith, and Michael Bryant. So, Michael, you're the man who brings all these props into Law and Crime. Is this discrepancy on the type of hammer fatal to the state's case, or does the state just say, well, the girlfriend didn't see the hammer?
I prefer to call them demonstrative exhibits. But anyway, Aaron, you know, what I think it's critical to help the defense do is call into question some of the testimony of Curtis Wainwright. If you can't get some of the details of the hammer straight, maybe you're lying about everything. You know, the truth is always the same, but if you're making up stories, maybe you forget who had which hammer and who left what hammer where and what he did. I think it can be important.
Okay, Catherine Smith, so what of this discrepancy? Does the state just say again, you know, well, he didn't see the hammer. The bottom line is he had a hammer. Maybe Wright just forgot the detail. Does the state get to gloss it over that way?
I think they can, and I think they should. I don't think it's that big of a deal. I mean, we just heard the ME testify today. He doesn't know how many hammers were involved. It was a hammer. I mean, and at the end of the day, how does this connect with Seavers? Just not that important.
Adam, let's talk about this girlfriend now. Is money affecting her credibility? I mean, I rarely ever have seen a case where the state just pays someone $400 a month to help out with random expenses.
Does it play a factor? Maybe. But if this is really where the defense is going to hang their hat, that she was getting $400 a month and she's selling out her fiance and accusing two other innocent men of murder over the prospect of $400 a month, I think that is a big stretch.
And let's jump back here. Michael Bryant, I got to ask you about these fibers that we heard about at our beginning of review of testimony in this case. The defense is saying, well, you know, there's animals in the Seavers' house. The other defendants didn't have animal fiber from the Seavers' house on their clothes. Is the defense trying to say they weren't there at all? I mean, one admitted it and the other was already convicted.
Yeah, exactly. And that's no great shock to anybody. You know, we get spoiled by the DNA and the fabric and the fibers. And, you know, you don't find everything. And it's not necessarily totally dispositive just because they didn't find one element or another. You can't put too much into that.
All right, well, we're going to continue our review of this case at the end of the broadcast. Still ahead, though, tonight, we're going to talk about a plea deal in Ohio's Pike County Massacre. Plus, as I said, we're going to go back to the Mark Seavers case with testimony from friends of the victim and the defendant. They testify about arguments and odd behaviors on behalf of that defendant when we return. Welcome back to The Debrief. A plea deal today connected to Ohio's so-called Pike County Massacre. Rita Newcomb agreed to obstruction, a second-degree misdemeanor. The state dropped four other charges against her. Newcomb, a notary, admitted she did not actually sign custody documents relevant to the case. Wagner's daughter is the suspected mastermind behind the killings of eight members of the Roden and Gilly families, with whom the Wagners had custody disputes. Wagner, one of the other defendants in that case. And now, a quick check on other cases we're following this week. A hearing tomorrow in the criminal prosecution of millionaire real estate heir Robert Durst. Prosecutors in California say he killed a woman because he wanted to silence her. They say she knew Durst killed his own wife decades earlier. We'll be monitoring tomorrow's hearing. A trial itself is scheduled for February. We are also standing by in Arizona for opening statements in the trial of Ramon Bueno. He stands accused of shooting State Trooper James Casey in the face. Casey survived and is expected to testify. Americans know Casey through the hit show Live PD, hosted by our founder, Dan Abrams, and broadcast on A&E. A&E, of course, owns a portion of the Law and Crime Network. In response to our tweets about the upcoming coverage of the case, Trooper Casey tweeted, "I've waited over 5 years for this day to get here. It begins tomorrow. To say nerves are beginning to set in is a huge understatement. Wish me the best. We'll chat after the trial." Now let's turn back to testimony in the Mark Sievers trial. A series of the victim's friends testified, including this one, who said defendant Mark Sievers became extremely worried when police began arresting his friends.
Mark called me when Wayne was arrested and was panicked, I would say, worried that he was going to be arrested next. And, you know, seemed panicked about the fact that Wayne had been arrested. And it was a surprise to me learning that Wayne had been arrested. He was emphatic that Wayne had nothing to do with this and that there's no way Wayne would be involved and that this was clearly the police fabricating a case against Mark and Wayne.
Did he seem at all upset with Mr. Wright about being arrested for killing Dr. Sievers?
Definitely no anger whatsoever, even at the if he possibly was going to be related to the death of Teresa. And that didn't change every time we talked. So, you know, that seems strange to me.
Another of the victim's friends said Mark Sievers had a strange reaction to learning about his own wife's death.
We hugged immediately, and then he sounded as though he were crying.
Now you made you're making a distinction there that you said he sounded like he was crying.
I say that because he sounded like he was crying and his body was quaking like he was crying, but when we looked at each other, I was searching his face and there were no tears, no red eyes, no runny nose. We had a conversation about who was going to take care of the children in the event that he could not. He literally dropped to his knees at the foot of the bed and he started talking about money and the fact that he was very concerned about how he was going to make money to raise the girls financially. And he said that he didn't have a job, he hadn't worked for anyone in years. And I said to him at that time, "Mark, when you asked me to be guardian of the girls, you told me that there was a very large life insurance policy. You told me that the girls would be very well taken care of." And he immediately had a look of relief on his face and he put his head in his hands and he said, "Oh, I totally forgot. I completely forgot."
And yet they say that's part of the motive. Well, next, a neighbor to the victim and the defendant testified that she heard arguing when she wanted to invite the Sievers over for a cookout.
There was some profanity, but she says, "I'm tired of this crap. I'm leaving."
Did she use the word crap or some other word?
Yes. She used another word.
Okay. Was it a bad word? Okay. So she said she's tired of this and she used a bad word.
I'm effing tired of this, so.
Okay. And she said she's leaving.
Yes.
And did you hear Mark Sievers' voice respond to that?
Yeah, his wasn't as loud. She was more loud. He says, "If that's what you want to do, fine. But we'll see about that."
The defense accused several of these witnesses of never telling the most incriminating portions of their stories before until now, or at least very late in the case.
All said and done, is it fair to say that You have given approximately 8 interviews to various news outlets.
Yes.
Okay. And the story you recounted with the state just now, we first heard about that story from an article that was published in Gulf Shore Life. Do you recall that?
Objection is to the form of the question.
Overruled.
Do you recall that?
Yes.
That was the first time we heard that in Gulf Shore Life. And do you remember that interview that you said that you were terribly upset for the Seavers girls, the children?
I do.
Okay. And you said that you were going to do whatever you had to make sure those girls got justice. Do you recall saying that?
Nope. No, I don't remember saying that.
Do you recall saying that after Mr. Seavers was arrested that you felt relieved?
Yes, I do.
Here one final time tonight, attorneys Adam Conta, Catherine Smith, and Michael Bryan. So, Adam, what do you take this from this testimony here? Are these people just really trying to pound the nail in this defendant's coffin, so to speak? Do you believe what they're saying, or did they just wait too long to tell the story, and maybe they just want to see someone convicted?
I think both. I think it's a very powerful tool for a defense attorney to use when you have a victim, or excuse me, when you have a witness who's changed their story or omitted really large facts. But that doesn't change their delivery and what they're saying. I thought the neighbor, they all sounded pretty genuine, and their motive for lying is just not there.
Yeah, I mean, what are they really standing to gain out of this? I mean, one was allegedly involved with custody at some point. I haven't tried to ferret that out, Catherine. I thought a lot of that testimony was coached. Whenever the witness is a lay witness and they're just turning to the jury for almost every single comment, someone told them to do that.
That's very true. You know, you don't want to have that coach feel, but in reality, everybody is going to be coached. Every witness that's going to go before the jury is to some extent going to be coached. The question is whether or not they're being coached in a truthful way or whether they're being told to say something that's not true. And here, I just don't see the motivation for them to lie. It's a real stretch to think that all of these people who have no interest in the case are all just going to lie.
And Michael Bryant, we have just a couple seconds left here. Ultimately, does it matter? Does this evidence really stack up to equal guilt, or is it just icing on the cake?
I think this is the, you know, the holy cow stuff, because it really does cement the relationship between Seavers and what he may have done to cause the death of his wife. It's key. It's critical. I think the jury's going to put a lot of weight in it.
It makes him out to be the ringleader, as prosecutors allege. Let's move along here at the end of the broadcast. Thanks a lot to the panelists. We'll see you here tomorrow at 5 on the Law and Crime Network.